Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe continues to host the program from home with continuing concerns about protecting us all from the COVID virus. Today, Fred will talk with researchers from the Cal Poly Center for Coastal Marine Sciences. They will help us understand how offshore wind energy may be a truly viable, clean, and renewable energy source for consideration here on the Central Coast. Join Fred and his guests today for this very important discussion. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today. You can call in a question at 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Now let's join Fred and his guests. Over to you, Fred.
Great. Thank you, Brad. Glad to be with you today. Offshore energy is something that's been talked about on the Central Coast a lot. And it's become a politicized issue in some circumstances and an environmental issue, of course, is what it is. Today, we're really going to have a conversation with scientists. We'll do our best to keep this as informative as possible. And while you can certainly pose questions that may be more of a geopolitical nature from that standpoint, what we're really attempting to do today is give ourselves a better handle on what's possible, what's conceivable, and what's even in the works on the Central Coast. My guests today are Dr. Yiwei Wang, and she's a postdoctoral researcher with the Cal Poly Center for Coastal Marine Sciences, Dr. Benjamin Ruttenberg, who is the Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Cal Poly, and also Director of the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences. We're going to look at what the possibilities are for marine science, from marine science perspective, for offshore energy. It's a topic that's been discussed a lot, but we're going to have an opportunity today to maybe look at some parts of it that you haven't thought about before or hasn't even come up on your radar. You're welcome to pose your questions to us by either sending them to voices@kcbx.org. Or you can call the studio at 805-549-8855, and they'll relay your questions through Brad, our in-studio engineer, from that standpoint. One of the things that may come up as a question that you may want to share with us as early in the program as you can, because I want to encourage you to be part of the discussion early in the program, so we're not concerned about maybe fitting in your question at the very end. But your concerns might be, what about this particular type of energy concerns you, or what you've heard about it that may be of a concern from that you'd like kind of sorted out from that standpoint. I'll also remind you that if you send us an email for the program and it's an elaborate question, I don't want it to fall by the wayside. I'll make sure if we can't answer it on the program that my guests get a copy of your email directly so they may be able to respond at some point. I'm not quite sure where we begin other than what is this all about? Are we talking about a giant wind farm about, 100 yards off the Avila coast? Is this the kind of thing that takes place 30 miles off the coast so none of us would necessarily see it anyway? Because I think we look at visual circumstances in a coastal region more than we look sometimes at what the real scientific or environmental stances might be. So I'm not quite sure how we address that question, but I can count on both of you for sorting it out for us.
Thanks, Fred. And we appreciate the invite and the opportunity to come talk about this very important issue on the Central Coast. The process of offshore wind is pretty complex. I mean, obviously there's all the engineering issues and then the environmental issues, and then there's the sort of the public policy and process issues. I guess to answer your first question about where these things would potentially be located, there's a single federal agency called the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. That's part of the Department of the Interior that is responsible for managing, granting, and enforcing leases in federal waters. That's anything more than 3 miles offshore. So it's highly likely that any offshore wind facility in California is going to end up, at least any significant offshore wind energy farm is going to end up in federal waters, very far offshore. And so the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, and we will probably refer to it often as BOEM because this is how we talk about it. And so I will slip into that often, has identified a couple of what they're calling wind energy areas. These are priority areas for potential wind energy development. One of them they're calling the Morro Bay wind energy area. And that's anywhere from 25 to about 40 miles off of kind of Cambria, sort of a little bit north of Morro Bay. The other is up in Humboldt County. So, probably about 20 to 30 miles off of Humboldt Bay. So those are the two wind energy areas. And so any substantial wind farm will likely be located very far offshore. Again, minimum distance would probably be about 25 to 30 miles and potentially 40 miles or even a little bit further offshore.
So we can specifically say that that's beyond the visual range of the average person standing on shoreline.
I guess on a very clear day on the Central Coast, we don't get a whole lot of those. With no fog, if you're standing up on a hill, you'd be able to see them. They'll be pretty small. And so it's certainly not going to be, turbines anchored into the seabed 100 miles off of Morro Bay. 100 meters off of, or 100 yards off of Morro Bay. So they're going to be really far offshore.
Yeah. Because in my mind as a layman, my thought has always been, and I'm not quite sure where this information came from. I'm not a scientist. But generally speaking, the naked eye of a person standing on shore cannot see further than about, even if they have the ability to discern and focus that far, they can't see anything further than 15 miles offshore. That's reasonable to say.
That's a great question. I'm actually not sure.
Yeah. And that may have come actually from my previous experience dealing with ships in the Navy that you generally could not see another ship if it was closer than or further than about 15 miles, just based upon the angle of the world.
One thing I want to add this question is the concern about this view shade. To answer this concern, some project will do some simulations about the visual impact on the different scenarios, so that the results from those visual simulations can also help answer the questions you have.
Because as we're having this conversation, it occurred to me some of the mapping that I've seen of this, when you look at the California coast, it may look very, if you look at the entire state, things that you're looking at may appear to be very near the coast only because the scale of the map is such that you're covering a tremendous amount of coastline relative to how you perceive it as to how close things are.
Yeah, so if you look at the whole Central Coast, that's, several hundred miles on a map. And so, something that's even 25 to 40 miles offshore looks closer than it is. The other thing to keep in mind is that these turbines are likely to be very large. The current turbines are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of around, a little less than 100 meters or so, around 100 meters tall. That's, somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 feet. The sort of next generation that are going to be proposed for the area will probably be somewhere, around 120 meters. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 feet, maybe a little bit less than 400 feet tall. So these are pretty big, especially when you put the blade on top of that. So they're large structures. And so, I think it's going to be more a function of the clarity of the weather, on a given day when it's super clear. Yeah, you might be able to see them from the top of the hillside, but they're certainly not going to be, an eyesore, like you've seen in some people may have seen some of the images from the North Sea, off of parts of Europe where those turbines are very close to shore. they're inshore, they're close, they're in shallow water, and they're actually affixed to the seabed. So here, you know, we're talking about turbines that are going to be very far offshore, and they are going to be floating, right? They are not going to be driven into the seabed. They're going to be anywhere from probably, you know, 500 meters, that's around 1500 feet, to at deepest, you know, 1300 meters, that's 4,000 feet deep. So they're not going to be stuck into the seabed. They'll be attached to be a very, very long anchor to the seabed.
Okay. So do we have a timeline as to when, I mean, if all of the scientists in this discussion could be told today, start building a system tomorrow, how far away are we really?
I think I can take a step to answer this question. It's very difficult to make an accurate timeline for a wind, offshore wind project, but listeners can check out the website of BOEM. There it lists like the four phases for one renewable energy project that consists of planning and analysis as the first step, and followed by leasing as the second step. And the site assessment would be the third one. And then the last would be operation and construction, construction and operation. And each phase could take several years, and depending on how things goes. But for the project from the beginning to the end, to when the wind farm goes online, it could take multiple years.
So where these exist in Europe now, where if someone were wanting to really do some personal research, where could they see a project like this that's currently in operation? Are there any projects anywhere that they that someone could see that are currently under construction or under development enough that you could watch?
Yeah, actually, the first floating wind farm is off of a little bit north of Aberdeen, Scotland, so off of the east coast of Scotland in the North Sea. Most of the North Sea is actually pretty shallow, and one of the companies from Norway put in a floating facility in, I think it was around 100 meters of water, so 350 feet of water.
That's extremely shallow.
That's much shallower than it would be here. But this was installed, I think, 2016 or 2017. And it was the first floating wind farm. It was only five turbines. I'm going to say only five turbines, which is basically a small demonstration project. But the idea was kind of a proof of concept for them to get these turbines in the water, start, you know, turn them on, see how much power they developed, see what some of those impacts were. And Yikwe and I were actually fortunate enough in 2018 to be able to go visit this facility and meet with some of the representatives of the Scottish government and also with some of the developers, along with some folks from a couple of agencies here in the US, to go find out what they had done and what that project looked like.
Did either of you both got to see it? I mean, did either of you come up with what I would classify as a startling surprise that you hadn't thought about? By the way, I realize you're scientists and you should not have startling surprises unless you go look for them. But I'm wondering if there are, I mean, as projects like this develop, there may be things that had just not come up on anybody's radar.
I guess for, you know, startling surprises are actually the most exciting things that happen in science. But most of, you know, in this case, you know, the engineering for the turbines, it's actually reasonably well worked out. You know, we have sort of these large three blade turbines. That's the design that most of these are going to be using. You know, the Europeans have developed this fixed bottom turbines, being able to pile drive them. And really all you're talking about, I say that simply, like totally minimizing the work of many, many engineers, but you're basically taking that same turbine design and just figuring out a way to float it. Kind of like if you imagine the little spar buoy, that little buoy at the end of the swim area that stands upright. It's got a little weight, it's floating, it's anchored to the bottom, you know, maybe in 10 feet of water. So basically you're just talking about that thing and putting that on a huge scale, and then putting a turbine on the top. Obviously there's a lot more to it than that, but you know, the technology is fairly mature and fairly well advanced in that case. The thing that actually surprised me when we went to visit this facility in Scotland was how little environmental monitoring was occurring. The permitting agency didn't require the company to do a whole lot of environmental monitoring to understand what the, you know, so the broader environmental impacts were. And so there wasn't a whole lot of data that they were collecting. And so that actually was very surprising to me, given, you know, the importance of that environmental monitoring and that environmental data to all of the processes here in the US and especially in California.
Is that possibly a different political view of the region, or was it or a feeling that it literally wasn't necessary?
That's a great question. And I actually don't know. We were only there for a couple of days, you know, not even a full week. And so, you know, obviously I don't understand that, you know, I don't know that much about the culture of the Scottish government or the UK. And so, you know, why it was that they weren't collecting all of this information, I really don't know.
Yeah. Iwe, did you see it that way? Was that very similar to how you saw it, or were you, you may have had a different perspective, obviously. Well, you're a different person, you have a different perspective, but I'm just curious.
I'm glad you asked. No, I have similar feeling suspense. It was amazing to see like a giant turbine in short distance, and you can see how big the cables are and then how huge the turbine is. And one thing I want to add about the engineering part is that for building floating turbines is actually get a lot of experiences and lessons from the oil and gas platforms, because they use similar floating technology. Yeah.
Mm. Well, and that brings up an interesting question when you mentioned that, because if it's similar floating technology, one of the things that occurred to me is there, if you're getting a turbine to turn, there is resistance, and resistance means, and you're catching wind. So you're intentionally, to some extent, making the surface of your turbines a wind barrier, if you will, because if there's no barrier nature to them, they're not going to turn. And I'm wondering whether or not that becomes a kind of a balancing act of literally how you make it work effectively, but also come up with a way to anchor it where it's not actually anchored to the, or not actually hard bolted to the ocean floor, if you will.
Yeah. So our understanding, again, we're scientists, not engineers, first disclaimer. But our understanding basically is that they have cables that, you know, imagine a cable that's, you know, probably about six inches thick, steel cable, very long, down to giant anchors into the seabed. There's a couple different types, but just imagine, you know, a big concrete block the size of a room with a bunch of cables embedded into it. each of those turbines is going to have at least three of those anchors. And what they told us when we visited was that first winter that they were deployed, they actually got hurricane force winds in the North Sea. And when the winds are spinning that fast, they actually have to shut the turbines down. They turn the blades in such a way that the wind blows through it and doesn't actually spin the turbine, because it would obviously be going far faster than the turbine can handle. And so they turn the blades, and so the blades don't spin when it gets that fast. But there's still a lot of force that could potentially push those turbines. And what they found after this massive storm came through was that the turbines did not move. The anchors held beautifully. And so they were actually really encouraged by that, that they weren't dragging, they weren't moving around. They were able to withstand this incredible storm in the North Sea and come out unscathed. You know, and the nice thing is we rarely ever get storms of that magnitude on this coast. You know, it can be rough on the Pacific coast, but we, you know, rarely get those sorts of, you know, massive, massive winds and storms, you know, essentially down, I don't want to say this far south. You know, those storms are much worse up towards Alaska, but but not nearly as strong as we they would have seen on our continent. Yeah.
So this location was seen as an opportunity because of how shallow the offshore waters are.
Yeah, the waters were relatively shallow, so it was relatively easy for them to deploy this. And it was an opportunity for them to start to test some of this technology, both putting them out and bringing the power back to shore. And one of the things that we know, Yihui, who is actually trained as an atmospheric scientist, can talk much more about this, about the wind speeds further offshore.
Yeah, I guess one main reasons when one main factor taking into account when sighting is the wind resource. So if the wind's strong there, then it's more likely to generate more power, therefore like revenues and meet the demand of electricity.
The science that you're working with, would this work anywhere? I mean, we're talking about the Central Coast. Your example is off of the North Sea above Great Britain. But there's offshore wind everywhere. So I would assume that this is feasible anywhere that people will get beyond their fears of tolerating it.
Yeah, and you know, like, a lot of Yihui's work has shown that the wind speeds are actually much stronger further offshore, which is one of the reasons people are interested in floating wind, because, you know, the inshore areas near coasts, the wind isn't nearly as strong, and you have this issue of the sort of the viewshed concerns that you mentioned earlier. So the further offshore you put them, as Yihui mentioned, the generally the stronger the winds are, so the more power you're going to get in those places, and you have less of these concerns about viewshed.
Yeah. Want to remind our listeners, if you want to be part of this discussion today, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855. Your message will get relayed through the station to us to actually look at your concerns and questions. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org. That's voices@kcbx.org. If you have some more elaborate questions that we can't get to today, or that are just by nature of the science rather elaborate, we'll pass it along to our guests today, and hopefully they can respond from that standpoint. The big question, and I'm not quite sure how it ever got out there, but the big political question a few years ago was some view that this kills too many seabirds. Literally, it's like you put a wind farm up and it's like somebody jumps in a fan and it kills them. So I guess we can stay out of the politics of this, but I believe the politics and the science may not be too far away, except for the fact that we need to maybe sort that out.
That's certainly one of the big questions we hear from people a lot is, well, aren't these going to kill lots of seabirds? Because, you know, when the wind turbines were put on land, you know, they tended to be smaller blades, which means that they spun really fast and they killed lots of seabirds, lots of terrestrial birds. And so the concern was that, you know, if these things are going to be even bigger, they're going to kill even more seabirds. And the short answer is that we don't actually know. You know, from our perspective as scientists, you know, one of our big disappointments is that this facility in Scotland wasn't collecting these data. You know, they weren't monitoring seabird populations. They weren't monitoring the impacts on seabirds. And so it's hard for us, you know, it's hard for us to say because we don't have any data. And, you know, whatever the birds are that exist in the UK, in the North Sea, you know, we have different species here. Their behaviors are going to be very different. But in general, they sort of, the feeling, and you know, based on some information about how seabirds tend to navigate, how they tend to fly, is that the impacts are likely to be much less on seabirds than on terrestrial birds. And there's a couple of reasons. You know, one, these turbines are going to be very tall, and the taller they are, that means that there's going to be more space between the bottom of the blade and the surface of the ocean. And most seabirds tend to fly, relatively speaking, fairly close to the surface of the water. And so there may be as much as 60 feet between the bottom of the blade and the surface of the water. So that's kind of factor number one. Factor number two is that those blades are going to be spinning much more slowly because they're big. And so birds will be able to see them a whole lot better and, you know, potentially avoid getting, you know, knocked by them. And then the other thing is that there seems to be at least a few studies in Europe suggest that these birds may be able to just fly around the facilities and not fly straight through some weird structure. You know, they're used to the open ocean where there is nothing out there. And so if they see something, some big floating structure, they're not going to be flying towards it. They're going to potentially be flying around it. You know, again, the equivalent, again, I'm not sure we don't actually know exactly how these birds are going to interact with these facilities, but this is part of our feel that collecting that monitoring data, that environmental data, to understand what these impacts are, is it going to be a critical part of any deployment of offshore?
Well, what comes to mind, I don't know exactly how similar what the onshore things. There's a number of turbines in the Salinas Valley on the upper part of the 101 route through the Salinas Valley that are pretty visible. I'm surprised at how slow they turn. They don't seem to create any auditory intrusion. But I suspect they're close enough to the ground that if there were a problem with land birds, we would know about. But are we looking at anything? Is this similar to what we're going to see offshore? What's going on in Salinas Valley?
Probably not, honestly. I mean, first, you know, the turbines they're talking about in the Salinas Valley, you know, there's kind of like a single turbine here and a single turbine over there. You know, yeah. If someone's going to be deploying something offshore, it's likely going to be a farm with, you know, 30, 50, maybe 100. So much, much higher density, although they're likely going to be at least, you know, a couple of kilometers apart.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to take a break here for a couple of minutes. And we'd like to have your questions and concerns. If you want to give us a buzz at voices@kcvx.org or by phone at 805-549-8855. We'll be back with our guests. If you're joining the program and haven't been in the discussion from the beginning, we're looking at offshore energy and wind farms as a possibility to address both environmental energy and climate change issues. And I'm talking with two scientists from the Cal Poly Center for Coastal Marine Sciences. And we'll be back with you shortly. This is Central Coast Voices.
I'm Brad Kyle with this item from the KCBX Community Calendar. Live Oak Music Festival is back from June 17th through the 19th at El Churro Regional Park, a Slo County park in San Luis Obispo. There are still spaces available for local food and merchandise vendors, volunteers, and artists to participate. Tickets for the festival are on sale now. If you'd like to learn more and see how this year's lineup looks, head on over to liveoakfest.org. Central Coast Voices will continue right after these messages.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA. Genias, a series on notable women in music history. A look at the life and story of the iconic La Lupe.
La Lupe was something extraordinary, and people, in order to explain her, they had to invent extraordinary stuff.
That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, Rupert Murdoch and the media empire he created, including Fox News. We'll talk with New York Times reporter Jim Rutenberg, who co-wrote a series of articles about how Murdoch's newspapers and TV networks amplified and profited from the right-wing populist wave. The series has been adapted into a CNN Plus documentary series. Join us.
early 70s advertisements to lure customers to fly with an airline were pretty wild.
With a picture of like a smiling white young woman looking right at the camera, and the tagline was, "I'm Linda, fly me."
I'm Amy Scott. Sexism and women in flight, next time on Marketplace.
That is ahead on our Thursday here on KCBX. Fresh Air from 3 to 4, followed by Marketplace from 4 to 4:30, and then All Things Considered from 4:30 to 6:30. Right now, let's return to Fred Monroe and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Fred.
Thank you, Brad. I have guests today from the Cal Poly Center for Coastal Marine Sciences, Dr. Yiwei Wang and Dr. Benjamin Ruttenberg. And we're talking about something that I think we should be talking about a lot more, because I think it would be a wonderful way to see energy generated in a non-environmentally sensitive fashion. Climate change is a real issue that we've talked about. We don't seem to we know it's there. We know we have to solve it, but we don't seem to be spending a lot of time talking about healthy ways to solve it. The conversation prior to the break was talking about, and among other things, Dr. Ben mentioned that in Scotland, where they visited a farm there, there's a surprising lack of environmental study going on as far as how both seabirds water mammals and other animals were affected by this. Ben, on the break, you kind of implied that you were surprised that the group in Scotland was not paying as much attention to this, and that it was a key area.
Yeah. So the company that deployed this, which is called Equinor, was monitoring only scouring of those anchor lines to the seabed. And the reason that they were monitoring that is that the permitting agency in Scotland was the only thing that they required them to monitor. So there was no monitoring of seabirds and no monitoring of marine mammals. And I don't even think much monitoring of fisheries. And so, you know, these are some key concerns, from people on this coast. And so, you know, part of our push is to try to, you know, start to think about a framework for, you know, collecting more comprehensive monitoring data to really try to understand what the potential impacts of deploying offshore wind might be. And are there ways for us to mitigate, for us to potentially minimize or reduce those impacts? Because as you said, you know, climate change is real. It is happening. And for us to reach our renewable energy goals, we need to do everything in our power. And, you know, we certainly at least need to have that really in-depth conversation about, you know, is offshore wind part of that solution on this coast?
Okay. We did get an inquiry by phone from Lee from San Luis Obispo, who wants to know how much power will actually be generated for the Central Coast and for elsewhere. And also, and we hadn't talked about this at all yet, the migration of whales and how that'll be affected by placement of turbines, because I believe those are really important questions.
Yes, I think I can answer the power questions. Our team actually did like a scenario study and try to look at how much offshore wind power can be generated under different scenarios, like using different turbines, considering different turbine arrays, etc. And we found that if like the Morro Bay wind energy area is fully built, then it can generate power, I think it's between 75% to 125% of the power generation by the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. So that is impressive, because as your listeners know, that the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant can supply about 8% of the state electricity demand. So the offshore wind power in the Central Coast could be substantial to supply electricity demand.
Okay. Further question with regard to whale migration issues?
Yeah, the whale migration is a great question. We know a little bit about whale migration routes, but you know, these animals are large and move around a lot, which makes them hard to study. Again, very preliminary work seems to suggest that many of those migration, that where these turbines are going to be, may be further out than many of the migration routes. Certainly for the, you know, the gray whales that migrate up and down the coast, you know, you can see them very close to shore very often. And so something that is 25 to 40 miles offshore may be outside of their migration route. So certainly, you know, one of our pleas is that, you know, there needs to be some more work done to really understand what's happening in the potential areas. You know, that's going to need some additional, obviously, funding for some research to get out and do the work on the water in these potential places. It is certainly possible, we hope maybe even likely, that, you know, as part of a lease agreement with any company, again, that hasn't happened here on this coast, but that part of the conditions of that lease would be including funding for research into what's happening in those specific areas. And certainly whale migration is going to be a big concern. You know, the big issue with whales and other marine mammals is the issue of entanglement, right? And we know that many of these animals can get entangled in fishing gear. But, you know, fishing gear is, you know, thin, very flexible rope, you know, a very flexible line. You know, these cables, as I mentioned, are, you know, likely to be several inches thick and incredibly taut. So from what we understand about the current research on marine mammals, it seems very unlikely that the marine mammals themselves would get tangled up in the anchor lines from these turbines. It's possible now that we could have what's called secondary entanglement, some, you know, fishing gear or some nets or some lines get hung up on the anchor lines themselves, and then a marine mammal or whale swims into that and gets tangled up. That's possible. It's also possible that a whale may have some fishing gear on it, swim through a facility and get tangled up on anchor lines themselves. But again, we don't really know how likely either of those things is. And I don't want to say this has not happened in Scotland, but I have not seen or heard anything that there have been any issues with entanglement on the anchor lines that they're using there. But again, part of that question can simply be addressed by collecting a whole lot of additional data and setting up a really, really robust monitoring scheme so that we know what's happening out there. And then if something gets entangled, then there's some way in real time to provide that information back to someone on shore to be able to potentially get out there and go rescue something should something like that happen.
Yeah. Thank you. Great information. We did get an email from Brad, and Brad wants to know, he says, among things that we hear about are the problems with the lifespan and the recycling of the turbine blades. He had another question, but we'll get to that in a minute too. Go ahead. Can you talk about the actual, I guess, the lifespan of the equipment, and is what we're looking at?
I think the lifespan of a wind farm is like 20 to 25 years, and I know that there are discussions how to repurpose and recycle those turbine materials after they decommission.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of discussion about the turbine blades and you know, once they come off of these turbines, then they need to be disposed of. I know that there are efforts underway to develop materials that are reusable and recyclable, but again, those are more engineering questions. You know, that's about how to design these things appropriately, and that's, you know, unfortunately outside of our expertise and our purpose.
Well, what were the, in Scotland, what are the blades made out of?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer.
Okay.
But that information is readily available. I think it should be fairly easy to find about how, right. What those blades are made from.
Thank you. Actually, Brad had one other question. He's curious to know what the speed of the blades are at the tip of the blades. Or it's how fast are they turning?
I'm not so sure the answer for this, but I think, like, for the existing wind farms, they provide the information online that your listeners may be able to find out the information.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that depends on, you know, how many rotations per minute those blades are. And then looking at the length of the blades, you can figure out what the speed is. They're moving quickly at the tips. You know, those tips are going to be moving very, very fast. Certainly enough that if something ran into it, it would likely kill it. But they're also moving slowly enough that they can be very easily seen. And so I think it makes it much less likely that something like a seabird is going to crash into it, which is, I assume is what that question is about. But again, those things are, you know, basic engineering that information should be fairly readily available.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And thank you to Brad and to Lee for your questions. If you'd like to have any other questions that you want to share, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org, and we'll do what we can to make sure your questions get addressed. I appreciate the fact that we're dealing with science today, and scientists don't necessarily have all the answers. Scientists learn that finding the answers is what science is all about, and I appreciate having both of you with us today. Are there any things in the time that you've both been working on this project or this research, are there things that have shown up that have been surprising, if you will? Or unexpected, I guess. Unexpected may be the area I'm looking for.
I mean, some of the work we did, you know, some of our initial work looking at potential power production, you know, that Yihui led this as the analyst. And I think maybe I'll kick it over to Yihui to talk about how the timing of power production matches up with the potential demand and other renewables.
Yeah, I think one amazing thing about the offshore wind energy in the Central California coast is the great alignment of the offshore wind power peak with the demand peak on a daily basis, because we all know that given the current technology, we don't have like large scale energy storage to store like solar power that produce a lot during the midday. But in the evening, during the peak hours, when people go home and then turn on their electricity appliance, and then that's so the gap of the demand can be supplied by the offshore wind power production. So we did a study and compare how offshore wind power changes with time in a day with demand and land-based wind and solar wind. And we found that offshore wind in this area aligns best among this among different renewable sources.
Yeah. So one of the big findings was that in the spring and the summer, you know, as Igor mentioned, as that solar production, you know, starts to ramp down as the sun goes down, that's often when people get home and electricity demand spikes. One of the things that we found from our modeling work was that the potential power production from offshore wind actually increases during that time, helping us meet some of that gap between the power production or power demand and the renewable production. So it seems to be really complementary to solar in terms of when solar begins to ramp down and when offshore wind peaks.
This what comes into mind as I'm listening to both of you answer this is there. PG&E owns a facility called the Helms plant, which is their ability. They were using Diablo to pump electricity during non-peak hours to basically move water up to an upper reservoir. Mm-hmm. When Diablo Canyon goes away, that facility would probably not be used for a nuclear plant. Whether or not it's possible for facilities like that to be put in line, if you will, with offshore power sources.
Yeah, certainly, you know, increased battery power storage, whether it's battery storage or pumping water. I mean, pumping water uphill up, you know, during peak time and then letting it come down is essentially just like a...
It's a battery, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically a giant battery. And so, you know, part of the solution is going to have to be, you know, more renewables and a whole lot more storage. But certainly, you know, offshore wind can be, you know, try to reduce that, you know, we should be able to reduce some of that gap between the peak in solar production and the peak in demand in the evening. It, that still doesn't mean we're not going to need more storage. We're still going to need a whole lot more energy storage than we currently have. But, you know, from the analysis that Yihui led, that offshore wind should help reduce that gap between demand and supply.
Well, that's if our only problem is storage, I think we're in great shape. And I believe that becomes a, when we're not looking at finding new renewable clean energy sources, but we're looking at only ways to store power we can store up, I believe we're in great shape. And that would be kind of where we're heading with this. We did get an email from Patrick. If these turbines are 25 to 40 miles offshore, how efficient is the transmission of electricity to shore? I believe that I'm assuming that Patrick's question has to do with whether or not there's loss of power based upon the resistance of a large movement by mileage on a cable.
Yes, I think there would be loss, electricity loss, transmission. And usually I think the estimate of like 10 to 20% of the power generated by the turbines may be lost on the like transmissions and other processes when transmitting power from the wind turbines to the users. So yes, there would be a power loss, but the range, I think, based on the modeling works, is between 10 to 20% would be a reasonable estimate.
Well, then I would pose an additional question to you, because generally I would think that power loss is lost and generates some heat, some a thermal loss also. Does that have an effect on the ocean floor where the cables are running?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we have not done any modeling on that. But you know, for starters, you know, the cables are going to be coming in, at least for part of it. They'll be coming in what we call subsurface. They'll be floating, but not on the surface. You know, we don't want them. No one's going to want them to be, you know, a ship potentially have a ship run into a cable. So they'll be, you know, maybe 100 meters or so below the surface, and then at some point when they get to shore, then they will bury them. There may be some thermal loss there. My guess, again, without having done any of the work, is that thermal loss will be absolutely negligible, will probably be virtually undetectable, just because, you know, water is such a high specific heat. It has the ability to hold so much heat, and there's a lot of water moving around out there. And so my guess, again, without knowing, my guess is that the heat component in the water would be probably very close to undetectable.
It needs to be studied at some point.
Absolutely. And again, that's something that should be fairly straightforward to measure. I mean, that, you know, it's even possible that those data are being collected in Scotland right now, and we just don't know about them.
Yeah. When you were in Scotland and you were talking about your surprise with data that was not getting collected, as to whether or not are the folks on that project now studying things that had not occurred to them to even study before?
That's a great question. I don't think we know. Okay. We haven't seen anything, so yeah. I don't know what they're working on.
Yeah, we did get a question from John, who's a fisherman from Nipomo. He observed that birds tend to fly towards boats and not away, usually for places to rest and for food. And whether or not that's going to affect how these farms are dealt with. I mean, are they going to become migratory homing grounds for birds?
That's another great question, and we simply don't know. And again, this is one of those when we see this potential, you know, there's facilities in Scotland and facilities in the North Sea, there may be data on these and we just haven't seen them. And so again, that should also be fairly straightforward to answer with some fairly straightforward monitoring, but we can't know until someone puts something out there.
We've talked about Scotland because that's the one that you got to actually see and pay mm-hmm. attention to. Are there facilities like this already in the United States anywhere? And so we're kind of on uncharted ground, if you will.
So for the U.S. right now, the development in the East Coast focuses on the fixed bottom technology. But in the West Coast, we have to use the floating technology because of the deep ocean. But right now, it's still in infancy because we don't have any turbines. We don't have any wind farms built in the East Coast. But we are still like in the phase of planning and analysis. But I believe that the government will have an auction sometime this year. I guess your listeners can read more news about that later this year.
Yeah. We hadn't thought about this, and I believe I'm not sure if our folks in the studio had got this as a question that's called in or their own, but thank you very much. How about sound and how it affects marine life? Do these things make a lot of noise? And what does that have an effect on marine life?
Yeah, another question. And the short version is that right now we don't know. They likely are going to be relatively quiet, certainly, you know, relative to, you know, the ships passing through shipping lanes are going to be a whole lot noisier than these turbines. And again, you know, I sort of feel like a broken record. But, you know, our plea is that, you know, part of all of these processes would include really, really robust monitoring. And certainly, you know, hydrophone arrays on any turbines deployed would be part of that, partly to monitor how much noise they're making themselves. And also hydrophone arrays, basically these are underwater microphones, you know, deployed in an array will give us a sense of that, you know, we can detect marine mammals, where they are, how many they are, how close they are. We can detect all of that information with sophisticated hydrophone arrays. So again, part of that would be, you know, part of any robust monitoring would include monitoring both for sound impact and also to use sound to try to detect the presence of other organisms.
As mostly happens with topics like this, and that is we kind of run out of time for some new slants on them, as all of our listeners are used to, and that is the fact that I want to make sure I get out of the way so my guests have the last words. Dr. Wang, why don't we start with you? What do you want to make sure that we don't forget from today's discussion?
I guess I just want to say that climate change is a serious issue for us, and offshore wind could be one of the solutions for us to reduce the carbon emissions. And of course, there will be changes with a new development in ocean, but we need more monitoring, like Ben said. We need more studies to help us understand what are those changes. Are they positive, negative, or neutral? And we need more studies to answer these questions.
Thank you. Dr. Ruttenberg.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to echo what Yihui said, is that, you know, that I think part of the process is just having these robust conversations and really fielding lots of questions about what people's concerns are, and then trying to think really carefully about developing the appropriate monitoring, the scientific protocols to collect those data, to try to understand those processes, you know, to try to understand what some of these impacts are. You know, are they severe or are they minor? You know, and if there are impacts at all or effects, you know, are there ways for us to, what we call mitigate, design something a little differently, change how we do something to try to reduce those impacts on the environment? Because we do need more sources of clean energy. One of the things that we're working on right now is what we call a trade-off analysis, where we're looking at different places in space and trying to understand what the potential power production is and what the potential value of that power production is, and then also understand what the potential effects on other users of ocean space, things like, you know, seabirds, marine mammals, and fisheries. And are there places where potential power production is very high and other users of ocean space, you know, are low, or that you know, there isn't much happening there? That would provide, you know, potentially sort of the win-win, like the most bang for our buck, where we get lots of that potential power and have relatively low impacts on all of these other things. And so, you know, these sort of processes, iterating this and, you know, really studying them in a robust way will help us provide the information that we need to make the decisions about whether we want to deploy these, and if so, where's the best place to put them.
Wow, it's delightful to do programs that involve scientists. It's because you never stop looking, and you obviously don't weed out the answers that you're afraid people don't want to hear. You want to really have this discussion. So I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you very much. This is Central Coast Voices. If you have any other questions for our guests, if you want to email them at voices@kcbx.org, I'll gladly pass them along to our guests. Chris Kington Barker will be with on the program next week, and she's going to be looking at Uplift Central Coast. And her guests are going to look at cultivating a space and aeronautics, ecosystem from Santa Cruz to Ventura counties. And that'll be the next program on Central Coast Voices. As you're aware, we talk about it all the time, this is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project underwritten by the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX. You can reach us with feedback on the program and suggestions for future programming at voices@kcbx.org. And thank you again to Brad Kyle in the studio today, keeping the fort down while we do this. Thank you to Dr. Benjamin Ruttenberg and Dr. Yiwei Wang for doing a wonderful program for us today on a topic that we'll be discussing for a long time, and we'll look forward to seeing some solutions to this, because as we know, global warming is a real thing that we have to address far more rapidly than we are. So I'm glad we have these kind of discussions. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back with you next week.